opinions expressed on this program are those of my guests and do not reflect the opinions of KN or its board of directors. Streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you would like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com. And this evening, I've got Nick Bryant with us, and, whoops, let me get this sound a little bit, and we've got a interesting evening, and we're going to get into a little bit different subject than I've covered in the past, but I've definitely felt it is, I've run into it numerous times, and it's time to address it, and Nick Bryant's writing has recurrently focused on the plight of the disadvantaged children in the United States. And he's been published in numerous national journals, including the Journal of Professional Ethics, Journal of Applied Developmental Psychology, Journal of Social Distress and Homelessness, Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved, and Journal of School of Health. He's a co-author of America's Children, Triumph of Tragedy, Addressing the Medical and Developmental Problems of Lower Socioeconomic Children in America. And Nick, are you there?
I'm here. It's good to hear you, Melody.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad that you've joined us this evening to kind of inform us on the book, The Franklin Scandal. And if you'd like to add anything else to your bio and or give us your website, that would so people can, when they hear this interview, they can go refer to that.
They can go to www.franklinscandal.com. That's the site, my website, franklinscandal.com. And there's a lot of different multimedia that your listeners can plug into if they want to be better informed about the book. And they can also buy the book at the website.
And can you, Nick, tell us why you picked this subject at this point in time and why you've, although John DeCamp had covered it somewhat in the past, what made you decide to take it a step further?
Well, I don't feel like I picked this subject as much as this subject picked me. when I realized that there was a reality behind this interstate pedophile network that had trafficked children for a number of years, and that it had been covered up by people in federal and state law enforcement, I felt compelled to write a book about it, because I felt it was just so evil, and so many kids had been destroyed, and the government had just done such an amazing job at completely vaporizing this scandal that I thought it needed to be addressed. And although someone had previously written a book on this subject, I felt that that book couldn't withstand rigorous journalistic scrutiny. So I set out to write a book that could withstand rigorous journalistic scrutiny and compile so much corroboration that people could not second guess it or say that it wasn't a reality.
So go ahead, and I'll just let you get more into the story of how this came about and all the details.
Well, I was looking into something else. It's kind of funny how journalism and fate are intertwined in my life at times. There have been a couple of instances where I've embarked on stories looking at something completely different, and then I just followed what I felt to be the truth, and then I ended up at a place where I never thought I'd end up at. And this is one of those stories. I was looking into the occult for a major magazine, and I came across a cult called The Finders. I came across a U.S. Customs report on a cult called The Finders, and the document, the U.S. Customs report, is just so bizarre that and so surreal and so horrific that it's excerpted in its entirety in my book, because we wanted to show the reader. And there's about 100 pages worth of documents in at the end of my book, because we wanted to show the readers of my book, The Franklin Scandal, that I wasn't drawing these really bizarre, horrific, surreal facts from the ether, that there are actual documents where I was drawing the facts. And what happened in the case of The Finders is that there were two adult finders. The Finders was a cult out of Washington, D.C. And they were in Tallahassee, Florida, with six kids. The kids, their ages ranged from like 3 to 6. And the kids really looked heavily abused. And now the finders were in a van, and the two adult finders, males, were very nicely dressed. And some Tallahassee citizens thought that something was seriously wrong with this picture, where you've got these six kids that just look like they've been out of something like Oliver Twist, and then you've got these two well-dressed men. So they called the Tallahassee police, and the two adult finders were very evasive and wouldn't answer questions, and the Tallahassee police saw the condition of the kids. The kids didn't know their names, they weren't aware of a lot of things that kids should be aware of, so the Tallahassee police just impounded everybody. They put the kids in protective custody, and they arrested the two finders on multiple counts of child abuse. And it later came out that social services had said that at least one of the kids showed signs of sexual abuse. And according to the customs report, there was pornography, child pornography, found in the finder's van. And so the U.S. Customs got involved. The U.S. Customs has its own unit that investigates child pornography. And so the U.S. Customs Service got involved, and the U.S. Customs Service quickly got a call from the D.C. police, because the finders had warehouses and houses in Washington, D.C. And the D.C. police said that they had an informant who told them that the finders were responsible for at least one murder, and that the finders were also responsible for quote-unquote blood rituals with children. So the U.S. Customs and the Washington, D.C. police served a search warrant on the finders' warehouses, and they just came across horrific documents. I mean, documents that talked about the finders buying children, kidnapping children, and they came across a cache of child pornography. And they really, I mean, what was in this warehouse, these warehouses, was just horrific, if you want to look at it from the perspective of child abuse. So as this investigation was really building steam, I mean, the FBI got involved, the D.C. police got involved, the U.S. Customs Report was involved, and then the Tallahassee Police Department was involved. So you ultimately had four law enforcement entities investigating the finders. But if you read further into the document, it ultimately, the U.S. Customs Report, after it talks about all this horrific stuff about the finders buying children and kidnapping and coming across this cache of child pornography, all these horrific things, the end of the Customs Report says that the CIA has basically quashed all investigations into the finders. And no more investigation, there will be no more follow-up investigations. And ultimately, the children were let out of, or were released from protective custody and given back to the finders. And then the finders, the two adult finders, were being held on multiple counts of child abuse. And I believe their bail was $100,000. And they were, and all their child abuse charges were dropped, and they just walked out of jail. And that just opened me up to a whole new paradigm. First of all, the CIA doesn't have any jurisdiction in the United States, or it's not supposed to legally. So what is the CIA doing quashing an investigation into a cult that is seemingly doing very nefarious things to children? I mean, if I hadn't come across that document, I would not have been receptive to the Franklin scandal. But unfortunately, I came across that document, and I started looking at things that I previously would have dismissed with skepticism.
What was the time frame for that?
Again. The finders, that happened in 1987.
Okay.
And then I heard about a similar situation in Nebraska. And it was tied up with the Franklin Credit Union, where kids had been trafficked across the country and used and abused for child pornography and also exploited by powerful pedophiles. And that this network had been covered up and it had links to the CIA. Now, had I not come across that finder's document, I never would have pursued this story. But after coming across that finder's document and authenticating it, or I should say the U.S. Customs Report on the finders, and then I authenticated it, then I realized that something was seriously awry here. And when I heard about what had happened in Nebraska, I decided to go there and check it out. I was still skeptical, but that U.S. Customs Report had kind of opened my mind to the possibility that the CIA might be involved with unsavory people who were doing unsavory things to children.
Okay, then just go tie in the Franklin scandal then with this.
Well, that kind of, I live in New York City, and my grandmother lives in Minneapolis, and I decided to basically visit my grandma at Christmas time and then rent a car and drive down to Omaha, Nebraska, and look into Franklin, the Franklin scandal. The Franklin scandal gets its name. There was a the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, which was created to provide loans to lower socioeconomic people living in North Omaha. And it basically fronted as the it was the front for this interstate pedophile network. And so the majority of the Franklin scandal takes place in Nebraska, although a huge segment of it also takes place in Washington, D.C., and I'll get into that later, where kids were being flown to Washington, D.C. And pandered to politicians and other power brokers. But so I went to Nebraska, and I had a friend who lives in Omaha, an old friend of mine, requested his couch for a week or so. I'd known him for a number of years at that point, and he said, sure, stop by. And I told him what I was investigating. He thought I'd lost my mind a little bit. But he knows that I'm a very experienced journalist, and that I said that there's some smoke here. I don't know if there's fire, but there's some smoke. So my first trip to Nebraska, and I went there like 14 times, but my first trip to Nebraska entailed interviewing some people that were involved with this pedophile network, and also some heavy harassment by the state police, the Nebraska State Patrol, and then actually a death threat at my friend's, I was staying at my friend's apartment, and there was a woman that issued a death threat to me while I was staying at my friend's apartment with my friend there. So that kind of turned both me and my friend around about looking at this. And then I concluded, by the time I went back to New York, I'd concluded that there was a reality to it. But I felt like I was light years from actually the corroboration that I needed, because basically the story is about an interstate pedophile network run by a GOP power broker, run by actually two Republican power brokers, and Lawrence E. King of Omaha, Nebraska, and Craig Spence of Washington, D.C. And they flew kids from coast to coast, pandered them to the rich and powerful, and blackmail was also involved. The Spence's house in Washington, D.C. was wired for audiovisual blackmail. And then the toothpaste started to come out of the tube. What happened here was social services in Nebraska was aware that Lawrence E. King was running an interstate pedophile network, or certainly a pedophile network, because of a couple of people, kids that had come forward, had talked about it, and then they found other bits of corroboration too. And when social services alerted state and federal law enforcement, they were just simply ignored. They were, and this really shocked social services personnel, because they felt that they had fairly significant proof that there was in fact a pedophile network, but they were just ignored by state and federal officials. So in the meantime, it kind of went dormant for a while. The first kid that came forward in 1986, and then a couple more kids. Well, one kid came forward and talked to the Omaha Police Department, and although the officer that interviewed her found her to be credible, she was never interviewed again. And the first kid that came forward, whose statement wound up with social services, she was never interviewed by the authorities until the toothpaste started to come out of the tube. And how did the toothpaste start to come out of the tube? Well, the Lawrence E. King embezzled $40 million from the Franklin Credit Union. Now, it was a credit union that was only supposed to have about $2.5 million. So when Nebraska senators found out that $40 million had been plundered from the Franklin Credit Union, they formed a subcommittee to look into it, because other savings and loans in Nebraska had been plundered throughout the 80s. And the senators perceived that there was an endemic systemic corruption within the Nebraska banking system. And when they heard about $4 million being plundered from a credit union that was only supposed to have $2.5 million in it, and Cook's books and things like that, they decided to look into it themselves, even though federal authorities said that they were looking into it. But the credit union hadn't been audited in 4 years. And federally insured credit unions, it's required that they're audited every year. So Lawrence E. King had the political juice to stave off yearly audits. And when they found out that it hadn't been audited in 4 years, that $40 million was missing, that there was cooked books, they formed a Senate subcommittee to look into the plundering. They had no idea about the child abuse allegations at this point.
Can I ask you, did they ever connect any of this at all to the other building and loan improprieties from in other states?
No, they didn't. They did not. And so senators formed the subcommittee, and shortly after the subcommittee was formed, these social services personnel came to them and said, we believe that Lawrence E. King and the Franklin Credit Union, or we believe that Lawrence E. King used the Franklin Credit Union as a front for an interstate pedophile network that pandered children to rich and powerful people. And the senators started to take a look at that avenue, the child abuse avenue. And in the meantime, law enforcement had completely denied that there was any child abuse, that there was any pedophile network. But these senators were very tenacious, and that they were put under a lot of pressure, too, because the FBI and then the Omaha Police Department said that they'd conducted an investigation after the subcommittee was formed. The FBI said that they'd conducted an investigation of the Franklin Credit Union and Lawrence E. King, and that there was no child abuse, there was no interstate pedophile network. But they ultimately got six kids to come forward. They hired an amazing investigator. His name was Gary Caridori. And Caridori and the committee ultimately got six of the victims of King's pandering network to come forward. And four of the victims gave videotaped testimony where they repeatedly corroborated each other on events, perpetrators, flights, on a myriad of different things. And so ultimately the Senate subcommittee gave the videotapes to the U.S. Attorney for Nebraska and also the Nebraska's Attorney General. And they had like over 20 hours of victim corroboration or victim testimony where the victims repeatedly corroborated each other. And so that ultimately led to the formation of a state grand jury, federal grand jury, that looked into the child abuse allegations. So the toothpaste had started to come out of the tube when these videotape statements of the victims were given to both state and federal law enforcement. They could no longer hide behind the allegations didn't add up or the victims weren't credible. Two grand juries were formed. And I had the good luck of acquiring the sealed grand jury testimony and exhibits of one of the grand juries. And I shouldn't have acquired it. It's sealed, but I eventually got a number of people in Nebraska to trust me enough so that they felt like they could give me the documentation and I wouldn't give them up. And in my book, I show how this grand jury was completely hijacked. And I don't know if your listeners really know how easy it is to co-opt a grand jury. But grand jurors are just basically citizens that have shown up for jury duty. And some of them are put on grand juries. Now, it's the special prosecutor. A special prosecutor is appointed as the person that actually shows the grand juror's evidence. So the special prosecutor is in a very powerful position to sway a grand jury. Because he calls witnesses that he deems are appropriate, and he shows the grand jurors evidence that he deems is appropriate. So grand juries are notorious for being swayed by a special prosecutor. Actually, a New York judge once quipped that a special prosecutor could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And so there was this state grand jury. And in my book, I completely deconstruct it, and I show just how corrupt and perfidious it was. And it ultimately declared that there was no child abuse, that the allegations were quote unquote a carefully crafted hoax. And it exonerated all the perpetrators. The kids had named people in the police and the judiciary, and also some scions of business. An industry, and the grand jury exonerated all the alleged perpetrators and indicted two of the victims for perjury. And one of the victims was indicted on 8 counts of perjury, and the perjury charges carried up to 1 to 20 years. So that kid was looking at about 160 years, and then for perjury. And then one of the other kids who wouldn't recant was looking at approximately 60 years. He was indicted on 3 counts of perjury. Their perjury counts were basically the same. They named the same perpetrators, and so. That's how that played out. And they decided, the Nebraska judiciary decided to try the girl first. She was 21 years old when she was indicted. And in my book, the largest chapter in the book is dedicated to her trial and her plight. And in the book, I show how the FBI intimidated victims to recant their abuse. But this girl just refused to recant her abuse. And in the book, I show how she was publicly crucified by a kangaroo court. And she was ultimately sentenced. And we're talking a kid here, a victim of child abuse who wouldn't recant it. She was sentenced between 9 and 15 years for perjury. And she spent nearly 2 years in solitary confinement. And it was imperative that the judiciary nail her, because they wanted, the other kids were told that if they kept on with the abuse stories, they would be going to jail for perjury. So that they had to make an example of her, but they also needed to sanctify the grand jury reports, both the state and the federal grand jury reports. And that federal grand jury indicted her on cause of perjury, too. But if she was found innocent, then these grand jury reports would be called into question. And so to sanctify the grand jury reports, the state pulled out all the stops. She had one of the longest trials, if not the longest criminal trial in Nebraska history. And the state put hundreds of thousands of dollars into finding her guilty. There was heavy-duty jury manipulation. I showed that the judge was either corrupt or completely inept or both. And there was evidence planted in the jury room. I mean, her jury, but she just happened to have a great lawyer who saw this travesty of justice occurring. And he stepped up to the plate to represent her pro bono, and he fought. They both fought to the best of their ability, and but they were going up against this juggernaut. And the media jumped in.
And the lawyer was?
The lawyer was Henry Rosenthal.
Okay.
He died last year. And then the girl that wouldn't recant, I mean, her brother died mysteriously. He was 17 years old. He supposedly hung himself. There was another victim who was having trouble, who was feeling ambivalent about recanting, and his brother supposedly shot himself in the head. There's my book is a veritable necropolis. Every chapter there are two or three either homicides or mysterious deaths.
And one of the things I wanted to point out too is when you go on the website, like on Amazon or whatever, the reviews of it are excellent. People have a lot of great things to say about your book.
Well, thank you. I spent 7 years and I traveled 40,000 miles in pursuit of the story. So I'm very happy that the people that are reading the book are finding that to be edifying. It's a horrific read. It's about child abuse and about the cover up of child abuse by the federal and state judiciary. So it's very unpleasant, but it conveys a very inconvenient truth that there have been interstate pedophile networks that have been covered up by the federal government, or a corrupt subgenus within the federal government.
But what you also are showing that it isn't just these cover-ups aren't just in these pedophile networks. I mean, when you're talking about grand juries and the court systems, and you get into dignitaries and banks, you're kind of scratching the surface of a lot of areas that this corruption gets covered up.
And also the media. The media really played an integral role in covering up. It's kind of interesting. This girl who was found guilty of perjury, the day that her jurors went into deliberation, CBS 48 Hours, CBS 48 Hours did a hatchet job on her credibility. The night that her jurors, the day that her jurors went into deliberation, that night, CBS did a hatchet job on this girl. I mean, why would CBS do a hatchet job on this girl the night that her jurors, or the day that her jury went into deliberation? And then there's some very fishy reporting by the New York Times on this. And also on the D.C. side, the Washington Post. I show that the Washington Post is heavily malfeasant. And to cover this, the cover-up was about, there was some very powerful people involved in this pedophile network. And through the sealed grand jury documentation and exhibits, I came across about 200 flight receipts of the rings, or of Lawrence E. King's. And there's no flight manifest, which is illegal. I mean, you've got to name the people that are on a particular flight. But it's just Lawrence E. King plus four, Lawrence E. King plus six, Lawrence E. King plus three. And but the vast majority of these flight receipts go to Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., Lawrence E. King had a partner named Craig Spence. And Craig Spence had a house that was wired for audiovisual blackmail. And I have Craig Spence confessed to some reporters that he was a CIA asset, and then I found other corroboration that Craig Spence was, in fact, a CIA asset. So you have a CIA asset who's also a GOP power broker who's taking part in this this pedophile network. And it was like Spence had just stratospheric connections to the elite in Washington, D.C. Congressmen would come to his parties, senators like John Glenn, Frank Murkowski, upper echelon members of the Reagan administration and what would become the Bush administration would go to parties at his house. Upper echelon members of the CIA, including William Casey, would go to parties at his house.
Now, wasn't there also there was also some media moguls there too? Or
William Sapphire, the New York Times, Ted Koppel would also attend his parties, and yes, there were a number of media personalities that attended his parties. Now, I'm not saying that everyone that attended a Craig Spence party was a pedophile.
Right.
But how the parties went was there would be the party, which would be basically a political, you'd have a lot of political elites sitting around drinking cocktails, being lubricated on alcohol. And then around maybe 11 o'clock, 11:30, someone would either fire up a joint, break out a line of coke, or something sexually inappropriate would go down. And people that were kind of shocked or appalled by that, who wanted nothing to do with it, would split. But whoever stuck around would be provided with whatever they wanted. If they wanted children, they'd be provided with children. If they wanted young males in their early 20s, they'd be provided with young males in their early 20s. If they wanted young or females in their early 20s, they provided with females in their early 20s. Whatever you wanted, cocaine, heroin were also available. So if you stuck around, and keep in mind that people would be lubricated on alcohol at this point, but if you stuck around, and Craig Spence spent $20,000 a month at an escort service, and the person who ran the escort service was enmeshed in that network to a certain degree, although he never provided children. But he went on record with me. He's the only one that's ever I'm the only person he's ever talked to. And King and Spence brought him into their fold and told them all their dirty secrets. And he gave me quite a profound interview.
So as far as where were these kids coming from?
the first kid that came forward came from a very, very abusive foster home. And she was molested by her foster father at approximately 9 years old. And then her foster father and her foster mother pandered her out to this pedophile network when she was approximately 14 years old. A lot of the kids were runaways or just kids that had fallen between the cracks. And then the four of the kids that came forward said that Boys Town kids were involved. And I had a real hard time with that because I'd always looked upon Boys Town as sort of a utopia for troubled children. And but these four kids said that Boys Town kids were involved. And Gary Caradore, the investigator that the Senate subcommittee hired, compiled a list of like 60 victims, and approximately 10 of those victims were Boys Town students. And I did find some of the Boys Town students on that list, and they did talk to me about being part of this pedophile network or being molested by Lawrence E. King. So there's a tremendous amount of corroboration that Boys Town kids were involved in this pedophile network.
Now, was there some of the monies that from Boys Town entrenched into this building and loan money that disappeared?
Yes. Now, that's kind of fuzzy. I tried to follow the money trail between Boys Town and the Franklin Credit Union. There was an executive at the Franklin Credit Union that told me that Boys Town had several accounts at the Franklin Credit Union. Father Hupp, who ran Boys Town in the early, late 70s and early 80s, was one of my first interviews. And he didn't say that Boys Town kids had been pandered, but he told me that there was like a coup d'etat, and he was basically banished from Boys Town. And if he was on the campus, that he was to be arrested if he was seen on the campus. Boys Town is an incorporated village that has its own police department and its own post office and its own zip code. And Father Hupp, and this is what really shocked me, Father Hupp told me that although he didn't have direct knowledge of Boys Town kids being pandered, that he was told that if he was seen on the Boys Town campus, and here's the guy that ran Boys Town for 12 years, that he would be arrested. So that was like one of my first dents in my preconceived notion of Boys Town being a utopia for troubled youth. But Father Hupp told me that he had money in Boys Town and that he was told that it was a risky investment and that he pulled it out. And his successor, Father Peter, had said, although he didn't talk to me, he wasn't willing to talk to me, said that that Boys Town had money in the Franklin Credit Union, but it was from Father Hupp. I can't remember the amount, but not nearly the amount that this Franklin executive said was in the of Boys Town's monies that were in the credit union. So there's definitely financial breadcrumbs between the credit union and Boys Town, but it's very fuzzy to know exactly how much Boys Town had in the credit union. I was never able to discern that.
Now, was there other entities that may have been involved with some of this trafficking, like something like Offutt Air Force Base? Was that involved at all?
I mean, I heard innuendo about Offutt Air Force Base, but I was never able to really nail it. On the federal level, you had the Department of Justice was basically the puppeteer. And, I mean, they seem to have called all the shots. They had two federal grand juries. There was one in Nebraska, and then there was also one in Washington, D.C., federal grand juries that declared that there wasn't any pedophile network, there wasn't any blackmail, there wasn't anything like that. But the dirty work was done in D.C. by the Secret Service. It was the Secret Service that threaten people and kick down doors and held guns to people's head. And in Nebraska, it was the FBI that threatened people. They, according to an affidavit I have from a state senator, the FBI threatened to kill a perpetrator who thought about coming forward and was seeking immunity, a very wealthy perpetrator who didn't want to go to prison. And he was thinking about making a deal with the Nebraska Senate subcommittee, and the FBI agents threatened to kill him. And according to the victims, they were also heavily intimidated and threatened by the FBI. So the FBI did the dirty work in Nebraska, and as I said, the Secret Service did most of the dirty work in Washington, D.C. But then you have the Nebraska State Patrol doing the dirty work, too, in Nebraska, and the Omaha Police Department doing some of the dirty work. So there were multiple law enforcement entities involved in covering up this pedophile network, including the Nebraska judiciary.
Okay, now, did we not have some kind of congressional members involved in this, too?
There were the names that have come up as far as pedophiles that are potentially compromised are mind-boggling. They go pretty much all the way up the political food chain. Unfortunately, and I talk about this in my book, the kids generally came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, dysfunctional families, and they were turned on to drugs at a very young age. I mean, drugs was an integral role in getting these kids ensnared because the kids would be rewarded with drugs and money after they performed their sexual whatever they did with these power brokers. And then ultimately, you know, the kids really never really had a foundation, and they were turned on to drugs and alcohol. And then towards later puberty or later adolescence, they were just expunged from the network like gum that's lost its flavor. So these kids went on to become drug addicts and ultimately felons. And it's very difficult to, although I would have a tendency to believe that some of these kids, I've known them and talked to them for hours at a time, but for a kid to say I was molested by Senator X or I was molested by someone in the cabinet, I mean, it's because of this built-in mechanism where the kids go on to compromise their own credibility, it's almost impossible. I mean, how many kids is it going to take that are drug addicts and felons, or victims that are drug addicts that were drug addicts and felons? I mean, how many is it going to take to impeach the word of a vaunted senator who is seemingly a well-adjusted heterosexual that's happily married and has no scuttlebutt or negative press attached to his name? I mean, how many kids is it going to take? It's certainly not going to take one. It's certainly not going to take two. I mean, you would need like five or six kids to impeach the credit. But then there are people that are above that senator on the political food chain. So with the book, I was primarily interested in what I could prove. And I definitely proved the existence of an interstate pedophile network. I definitely proved the cover-up by the Department of Justice, by the FBI, by the Secret Service. I definitely proved that there was blackmail and high-ranking politicians involved. And I make a pretty strong case that the CIA was also involved, that the CIA was part and parcel of this pedophile network, as they certainly were attached to the Finders, the first trafficking network that I discussed. So I make very strong cases for that, but to go after individual politicians who are like senators or people in the cabinet or high-ranking administration members, it's very difficult because of these kids' histories or because of the victims' histories.
Well, I mean, that's not the only type of thing that goes on in D.C. I mean, we had some an instance that took place with the D.C. madam where it was, you know, primarily prostitutes and the like, but apparently she had a list that was rather long that could have, that seemed to be feared, and she ended up meeting an early demise.
Yes, well, I interviewed her predecessor, Henry Vincent, who was like the D.C. madam prior to Palfrey. And Vincent, this is kind of an interesting case with Henry Vincent. Now, he was providing hookers to Craig Spence. As I said earlier, Craig Spence was spending $20,000 a month at his escort service. And Vincent told me that both Craig Spence and Lawrence E. King pressured him into providing them with children. And he refused to do that. He felt what consenting adults did was their own business, but he refused to have anything to do with children. And he said that he grew so tired of King and Spence pressuring him and trying to intimidate him into providing them with children that he just said, "That's it. I'm done. I'm done working with you guys. That's it. I'm out of here. You might be spending thousands of dollars a month at my escort service, but I don't need the kind of headaches that you guys are bringing me." And according to Henry Vincent, Craig Spence sent CIA operatives over to his place, and they completely busted it up and threatened to kill Vincent and got him back in line. Now, it's kind of interesting. Craig Spence ended up committing suicide, or that's what his death is down as, is suicide in Boston. This blew up in Washington, D.C., too, like it kind of blew up in Nebraska, because the Washington Times, of all papers, was pursuing the story, and they were talking about Craig Spence having blackmail equipment in his house and blackmailing politicians. And Craig Spence was also giving midnight tours of the White House, accompanied by hookers. Male hookers, male hustlers. And one of the kids in Nebraska said that he was on a midnight tour, and the Washington Times corroborated that at least one minor went on one of the midnight tours of the White House.
And the time, the time frame for this is, again, the 80s? Is that what you're talking about?
This is under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration.
Okay, all right.
So you've got Craig Spence having all this blackmail equipment in his house, a self-confessed CIA asset. I found corroboration that it was a CIA asset. He was giving midnight tours of the White House with male prostitutes, and one of them that I know of was a minor, or it's been corroborated that one of them was a minor. So here was a guy with a tremendous amount of juice, and Spence let Vincent in on all his nasty little secrets. Spence told Vincent that the CIA equipment that was in his house was put in there by the CIA. And he also told reporters that his house had been, quote-unquote, bugged by a friendly intelligence agency. So Spence himself confessed that that the blackmail equipment in his house had been provided by American intelligence. So it's kind of funny that he ended up dead. Now, Henry Vincent ran an escort service, and the feds came after him on RICO. I think it was like 50 counts. I mean, he was basically running a prostitution service. I mean, he wasn't a big gangster. I mean, he was running a large escort service, but he wasn't a gangster. And but the feds really came after him like they came after the kids in Nebraska, put him in a full-court press, and basically Vincent was looking at like over 300 years in prison. And then the assistant U.S. attorney for the District of D.C. put a memo in with the judge saying that Vincent hadn't screened his escorts for HIV, so therefore he perpetuated the virus. And so he should be sentenced above the guidelines. So he was already looking at 300 years. And the assistant U.S. attorney sent a memorandum to the judge saying that he should be sentenced above 300 years. So that was part of their deal with Vincent, is that he would keep his mouth shut and that they would just give him 6 years. And he ultimately took that deal. And
so he went to jail.
He went to jail for 6 years.
Okay. And Palfrey, did she go? Was she the succeeding madam, or were there a number in between there?
She was. I mean, there might have been some ones that I didn't know about in between Vincent and Palfrey, but as far as I know, Palfrey was Henry Vincent's successor.
So that sends a pretty good message to anybody that's a madam of sorts in D.C. that, you know, it's kind of a risky business for themselves.
Well, if you get involved with powerful people and there's blackmail involved, and Palfrey said that there are powerful people that use my service, and you guys should be looking at whether or not these people were blackmailed. She said that before she committed suicide.
Right, but I also listened to several of her interviews, and she was very adamant to the fact that she wasn't even interested in revealing names. So it was kind of ironic that she still ended up suiciding herself.
Well, I think she was going to reveal names. I mean, that was part of her plan in her defense, I believe. I mean, I'm not sure. I could be wrong on that. But Henry Vincent would have had very interesting tales to tell. And he told me that he told the people at the Department of Justice about King and Spence's pedophile network, about its CIA connections, and about various people who had been compromised. But that's all been sealed. Everything that he said has been sealed. I've tried to unseal it. But we've all just been given runarounds. But I did catch the feds lying. They said that no high-ranking officials ever used Henry Vincent's escort service. Now, the names of some very high-ranking officials have come up in my investigation, and those names were corroborated also by the Washington Times. So the feds are lying about Henry Vincent's clientele, and then they're sealing all his documentation. So until the feds decide to unseal that documentation, I'm going to take Henry Vincent's word over the word of the feds.
So it almost makes you wonder, who are the feds working for?
Well, I think it was a cabal of people in intelligence, people in the Department of Justice, people in the Secret Service, and also people in the FBI. If you look at the entities that were used, that were deployed to cover this up, I mean, it was obviously... I think you get into the intelligence... industrial complex, and it's difficult to know exactly. I mean, I make a very strong case that the CIA was involved in this, but I prove that the Secret Service, the Department of Justice, and the FBI covered it up. In the book, I prove all that. I make a very strong case that the CIA was involved also. I don't have the CIA nailed. Look, I have the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Secret Service nailed as far as the cover-up, but I make a pretty strong case that the CIA could have, in fact, been the prime mover.
How much of your work intersects with John DeCamps?
John DeCamps' book and my book are very, very different.
Okay.
Your readers will have to read my book, and they'll have to read John DeCamps' book. But my book, I set about to corroborate my book so heavily that it was irrefutable and indisputable. And a lot of people felt that John DeCamps made a pretty strong case in some areas, but in other areas he was kind of... he didn't make that strong of a case. I make a very strong case for the D.C. side. I make a much stronger case for the D.C. side of it than John DeCamps did. I make a much stronger case for Boys Town involvement. And then I show, like, the linear progression of the cover-up and of the pedophile network, whereas John DeCamps kind of jumps around. And my book is fairly straightforward and linear.
Uh-huh. Did you run into a lot of the same cast of characters that he did?
I did. And he named some names that I don't, but then I named some names that he doesn't. So I ran into the same cast of characters that John DeCamp ran into.
And your investigator, Caradori, now he met an early demise too, didn't he?
Yes, Gary Caradori was the Senate subcommittee's investigator. And he was instrumental in getting four of the victims to come forward and give videotaped statements. And the feds started to go after him for fraud and corporate fraud. They were going. They tried to get the kids to say that Caradori, and actually some of the kids did say that Caradori fed them information and was responsible for various levels of malfeasance. And but that's not true. I mean, one of the kids that came out and said that later submitted an affidavit that said that threats from the FBI had forced him to lie about Gary Caradori. And other people have said that too. And the thing about Gary Caradori is once he realized that Fed's crosshairs, he realized that he had to find irrefutable evidence that this pedophile network existed. Now, there was a photographer that was part of this pedophile network. His name was Rusty Nelson. And I got to know Rusty Nelson very well throughout the course of this story. Rusty Nelson isn't the paragon of honesty, and he's not the paragon of morality. So it's difficult to take anything that he says at face value. However, he says that Gary Caradori contacted him, and he was Nelson said that the FBI and the was basically responsible for booting him out of Nebraska. When Franklin started to blow up, Nelson said that threats from the FBI ultimately led to his fleeing Nebraska. And but Nelson said that Gary Caradori contacted him when he was living in the Southwest. And Gary Caradori ultimately, Nelson said that Gary Caradori ultimately met him in Chicago, and that Nelson slipped him some pictures of these pedophilic orgies. All the kids that had been, five of the six kids that had come forward said that there was definitely photographs involved. And now Gary Caradori did fly to Chicago, and I've got Nelson saying that that he met Gary Caradori. Now, Gary Caradori told his wife that he would be meeting Rusty Nelson in Chicago. So, and Gary Caradori did call his wife. He felt like his phones were tapped, but he did cryptically convey that he had accomplished what he had set out to in Chicago. He also he also contacted the head of the Senate subcommittee and said, we've got him by the short hairs. And then he also contacted the mother of the girl that got 9 to 15 years for perjury, who was really concerned about her daughter. And Gary Caradori told this woman that told this girl's mother that she would be the happiest mother in the world when he returned from Chicago. So, and then he also called a reporter at the Washington Times who had been following this, and told him, and this was the least cryptic of all of his phone calls, but he told the reporter at the Washington Times that he was about to acquire pictures. And so I've got five corroborations that Gary Caradori basically acquired pictures in Chicago.
Okay, before
of these
Okay, go before we finish up on this, let's go ahead and do a station ID and then a brief break, and then we'll come back.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to resume where we left off. And again, this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my guest this evening is Nick Bryant, and we're going over his book, The Franklin Scandal. And we were just getting into,
we're talking about Gary Cattadori, the Senate Subcommittee's investigator.
Right.
And his trip to Chicago. And as I said earlier, the feds were coming after Gary Cattadori for fraud. They were trying to build a case against him to say that he scripted all the child abuse allegations. I know that this sounds very Byzantine, but there was a lot riding on it, including an administration and also a very corrupt political system of blackmail and compromise that Americans couldn't, under no circumstances, be made aware of. So Gary Cattadori was going to get these pictures in Chicago, and he was going to break this thing wide open. And I've got five sources that say that Gary Cattadori came by blackmail pictures in Chicago, and that included a number of politicians and a number of the kids. And his plane mysteriously broke up over Lee County, Illinois, and he was killed. And but Gary Cattadori is just one of many mysterious deaths in the Franklin scandal. Every chapter there's two or three either suicides or mysterious deaths or and it's very unfortunate because then the grand juries and the judiciary, and then the media, including CBS, just did a hatchet job on Gary Cattadori's credibility. And he was a great private investigator. He was one of the few private investigators that could have endured the wrath of the FBI and still made a strong case.
And when it comes down to Rusty Nelson, and you were saying that his credibility was compromised.
Well, his credibility is tricky. I mean, when your vocation consists of taking pictures of adults and children in sexually compromising positions, I mean, you're not the paragon of morality.
Right, and there was something to do with maybe, and I think it was it corroborated somewhat with Troy Boner, however you pronounce his name, and is maybe some snuff films being involved with this too?
There were two victims that said that they had witnessed homicides of other children, and that theme comes up also in Washington D.C. and from some other people where that and most of the kids that came forward said that they had been subjected to extremely sadistic pedophilic abuse. So the story that emerges is that you could do just about anything to these kids that you wanted to. If you just wanted to molest them without violence, you could certainly do that. But the kids that have come forward, that came forward to the legislative committee, and also the victims that I've talked to that were on Gary Cattadori's leads list. He provided the names of 60 victims, although there were a lot more than 60 victims, because I think this pedophile network was in existence for about a decade or so. But they all talk about very extreme sadistic abuse. And even Henry Vinson, who ran the escort service in Washington, D.C., told me that Lawrence E. King told him that the people that were renting the services of him could, in fact, kill the kids if they wanted to. And Henry Vinson, that just blew him away. I mean, he was from West Virginia. He was a coal miner's son. And he just, when King told him that, it just completely shocked him and blew him away. And he wasn't quite sure what to make of it. He said it was the most bizarre thing he'd ever heard in his life. So there's a tremendous, not a tremendous amount, but there's certainly some significant evidence that kids were being killed by some of these perpetrators.
And you worked with Bonacci?
I didn't work with anybody. I'm just a journalist.
As far as in getting information and
yes, I did interview Paul Benassi on a number of occasions.
Okay, I didn't mean working with. I meant Okay, and what did he bring about in this investigation?
Well, he told Gary Caradore that he had saw a kid killed during the making of a snuff film, and he gave me the same account. And actually, I'm going to put his account, his Gary Caradore interview, or parts of it, on my website at some point in the near future. And people can look at it and discern and decide whether or not they feel that he's lying. But he when he talks about the making of that snuff film, he does it with tremendous amounts of detail. And also, he's very effusive emotionally. He breaks down crying.
Well, wasn't he a victim of multiple personalities?
He was a victim. He did have multiple personality disorder, yes.
And
that's endemic of a lot of these kids. These kids got very, very damaged. As I was talking to you earlier, these kids were extremely damaged. I mean, they weren't the paragon of emotional health because of their respective upbringings, or the vast majority of them weren't. And then they were subjected to drugs and extremely sadistic pedophilic abuse. So they ultimately went on to become drug addicts and perpetrators and felons. And that's why the system is perfect, because these kids ultimately become perpetrators themselves and thereby compromise their own credibility. So there's no way that one or two or three of these kids are going to say, I was molested by such and such, this lofty businessman or this exalted politician, and no one is going to believe them because of their own personal histories.
Yeah, but
So the system has a built-in protective mechanism.
Right, but one reason why I was going in that direction of asking you this is because are you familiar with any of the work of the book Transformation of America or Kathy O'Brien?
Paul Benassi said that he was a victim of mind control. If you had read my book, I talk a little bit about mind control. I bring in a number of studies in my book at the end, in the epilogue, including the extreme abuse survey, where I think 1,200 respondents were questioned about their extreme abuse, and I believe like 900 of them said that they had been victims of mind control. So, and this was a study that was put together by four people with a lot of credibility, and then there was another study of multiple personality disorder done in Denver at the Denver Dissociative Clinic, and those people convey horrific tales, too, of witnessing homicides. Actually, it's kind of interesting. Of the people that said that they were ritually abused in the Denver study, 83% report that they had witnessed at least one homicide. And in the extreme abuse survey, which was much bigger, about 82% who said that they'd been subjected to ritual abuse said that they'd witnessed at least one homicide. So, ultimately, with the extreme abuse survey, you're talking hundreds of people. Now, are all of them lying? I mean, are the people at that were part of the Denver Dissociative Clinic? Are all of them lying? Are all these kids lying? And in the Franklin scandal, when they say that they witnessed, so there's a lot of evidence out there. Mm-hmm. That says that ritual abuse exists and that it does get very sadistic and can oftentimes lead to homicide.
But even when you start studying a little bit about how these people become multiple personalities, quite often there is something that is done to make them dissociate, and it wouldn't be uncommon for them to be put in a position to do so through maybe a murder or some very horrific experience for them.
Ritual abuse is often, a lot of the people that our multiple personality disorder talk about being ritually abused. And that seems to be a way that people can split people's personalities up into a multiple personality disorder. In my book, I only talk about stuff that I can prove. Mm-hmm. And there was only one victim who said that he was a victim of mind control, and that was Paul Benassi. But I do bring in a number of studies that talk about ritual abuse and some studies that talk about mind control. And then I've got a CIA mind control document that's actual from the Freedom of Information Act that talks about the CIA splitting kids up or splitting people's minds up into multiple personality using drugs, electroshock, hypnosis, and quote-unquote psychological tricks. And the document, it's the CIA's document, said that they were using children for that, amongst other subpopulations. So the CIA has induced multiple personality disorder through drugs, hypnosis, and electroshock, and also quote-unquote psychological tricks. So it's and I do bring this stuff in the epilogue at the end of the book.
And how about
when you read the book, you'll see that there's some fairly significant evidence that this has gone on.
Okay, now don't a lot of these subjects also have incredible memories, and that lying is not necessarily something that I even saw it referred to by one person saying that they can't lie. Now, where do you go with that?
Well, the theory there is that that if they feel an emotion that's uncomfortable, they'll switch to an ultra personality. Now, the ultra personality can give a different story than one of the other personalities or give a different perspective of the story, but they're not pathological liars. As like a sociopath would be. But if they do encounter unpleasant emotions, they can completely shift personalities. And different personalities can view a certain event differently. So, multiple personality disorder does not entail that someone is a pathological liar.
So your key person probably was, do you name the names of the people in the book, of the ones that were the primary ones speaking out, and the names of, possibly some of these, those involved? Or
I do. Okay. And if people can read the book, there are some politicians that are just so far up on the political food chain. I name them. As I said earlier, with this book, I only go into areas that I can prove absolutely. And what I did in this book is I just took on things that I could prove. John DeCamp, his approach was different. He brought in things that he couldn't prove, or things that had come up once. But I was very strict and rigorous as far as my approach to this story, because I felt it was a significant story, and I really felt like it should be brought into the mainstream media. So I just went after events that I felt I could prove.
So do you feel like that you're accomplishing that right now? Are you getting this out there in the manner that you desired?
I live in New York City, which is the epicenter of multimedia, and I have a lot of friends in media. I've been a journalist in New York for 15 years now, and actually I'm a little troubled by the way that my friends in New York media have reacted to this book. They the vast majority of them refused to touch it, and Oprah or her producers have refused to touch it. Nancy Grace or her producers have refused to touch it. Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow or her producer or their producers have refused to touch this book. The book has been given to other people too. and they've just refused to touch it. So, and I realize, and I'm bringing a story to them that is completely counterintuitive, that the government or a corrupt subgenus of the government is trafficking children. I fully understand that that statement is very loaded and is counterintuitive to how people feel about America. I understand that. But that's why I spent 7 years and I traveled 40,000 miles proving the book, the existence of the network and how it was covered up. I mean, that's why I put so much time into it, is because I wanted to prove it. And if you read the book, you'll see that I do, in fact, prove what I say I'm proving. Mm-hmm. And I've been a little disillusioned by some of my friends. The New York Times has the book. The New York Review of Books has the book. They won't touch it.
But you found
been a little frustrating.
But you did find a publisher who would do that, because it seems like DeCamp was unable to find one for his.
There was probably one publisher in the United States of America that would publish my book, and we just happened to find each other through either fate or sheer serendipity or karma, depending upon your theological, spiritual views. So, but we found each other, and I think we put out a pretty good book.
He's pretty courageous in a lot of the books that he seems to publish. So
yes, my publisher says that because the New York publishing is unwilling to touch certain subjects, he's kind of taken that upon himself. He's a very courageous man. His name is Chris Milligan.
Right. I've actually interviewed him on the program, and then I've interviewed a number of his writers from some of the books he's published, and they are usually quite controversial subjects. And is your book selling well for you?
It's going to a second printing this summer, and I'm happy about that. As you said earlier, I'm getting very good reviews on Amazon. And I'm happy about that. I'm actually getting some pretty good reviews in smaller print media. So I wish that the book would be selling worthy of bestseller status. But as long as people in the mainstream media continue to be so spineless, and you know, we're talking about child abuse here. We're talking about organized child abuse. And, we're not talking about embezzlement. We're not talking about corruption. I mean, we're talking about child abuse, which is the most heinous of crimes. So I'm a little bit perplexed that people in the mainstream media in New York have refused to take a look at my book, or have refused to publicize the book. And review the book. I find that a little perplexing. But New York media is filled with people from affluent backgrounds who have gone to very good colleges, who have drifted into very good, high-paying jobs, and they do not feel that their children would ever be abducted or fall prey to a pedophile network.
Yeah, but but one of the things that you're revealing in this is that if they are in these higher positions, that they may be much more aware of this and know people that are affiliated with it.
Well, the names of some very prominent journalists have come up in my investigation as far as being compromised, sexually compromised. So the Washington Post did its best to steamroll over the Washington Times story about Craig Spence having parties and blackmailing people. Henry Vincent told me that one of his clients was a high flyer at the Washington Post, very prominent journalist, and actually one of the more famous journalists in the United States of America. But I don't have any documentation on it. So who is America going to believe? Is America going to believe Henry Vincent, a convicted felon who ran an escort service, or a high flyer at the Washington Post, who's one of the most famous and revered journalists in the United States of America?
Oh, I can imagine who that is. Did you run into Johnny Gosch, the Johnny Gosch story?
Yes, Johnny Gosch was reportedly abducted by people that were affiliated with this network. And I've got some letters that were written about Johnny Gosch to Paul Benassi by people that had knew Johnny Gosch and Paul Benassi while he was in prison. The letters were written all over the country. Some came from New Hampshire, some came from Missouri. And I believe some came from California, and the letters talk about Johnny Gosch. Now, here's Paul Benassi in prison in the early 1990s. Johnny Gosch was abducted in 1982. And there are kids from various parts of the country talking about this pedophile network that Paul Benassi was in and Johnny Gosch was in. So I think at the end of the book, I get into the Johnny Gosch case, and I think I provide some pretty profound evidence that Johnny Gosch was alive, certainly in the 1980s, and into the 1990s.
And my understanding that, you know, somehow his name came up a lot when the White House journalist James Gannon was brought up into the media, even though some would claim that
that's pure apocrypha. I looked into it, and Jim Guckert, Jeff Gannon, is definitely not Johnny Gosch.
Okay, Jeff Gannon. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Well, I didn't think he was, but that it kind of helped bring about some of this attention back to this.
Yes, it did. It did. Okay. But I look into it, and I very quickly realize that Jeff Gann was not Johnny Gosch.
So do you think that... So this goes to the Eastern Seaboard. Did any of this go into the Western, like Bohemian?
Yes, the kids... a number of the kids were flown to California, or said that they were flown to California, and the name of one fairly prominent producer was mentioned by one of the victims, and some of the other kids had no idea who they'd been molested by. But the name of one very prominent producer was mentioned by one of the kids.
Uh-huh. And
so, but these kids were flown all around the country. I mean, they were flown to Wyoming. They were flown. Most of them were. I mean, most of the flight receipts I have were to D.C., but they were flown to California. They were flown to Colorado. They were flown to Minnesota. I mean, they were flown all over.
Now, were they? But were most of those kids coming from the Midwest there, or were they coming from all over too that were used?
Most of the kids that I talked to were either products of. excuse me. Most of the kids that I talked to were either born in Nebraska or had been at Boys Town. Even though they weren't born in Nebraska, they were said that they interacted with or got enmeshed in the ring through Boys Town. So, yes, the vast majority of kids. But I do know that Craig Spence provided kids, too. And I have no idea where he got those kids, but I'm sure that he got them somewhere on the Eastern Seaboard.
Now, when I was reviewing some of this, and again, I, because of the, you know, the tie-in with the bank and some of the information that John DeCamp had, he brought in, I believe, was it William Casey that he was working?
No,
with
it was William Colby.
Colby, right?
William Colby was when the Franklin. Committee, the subcommittee in Nebraska was looking into an investigator and a counsel. They wanted to hire William Colby. They'd heard that Lawrence E. King was affiliated with the CIA, and they felt like William Colby could be someone who might be able to shed light on it. And William Colby was willing to take the position of being the Nebraska Senate Subcommittee's counsel. Actually, he flew to Nebraska and he was interviewed for the job. And I believe there were 9 senators on the committee, and they shot down William Colby's appointment by 5-4 because some of the senators felt like once CIA, always CIA. But when Gary Caradore died, very mysteriously, in the plane crash over Lee County, Illinois, The Franklin Committee hired William Colby to look into Caradore's death. Now, here's where it gets interesting, because William Colby did not state publicly that Gary Caradore had been murdered. He was unwilling to do that. But I've talked to three or four people that say that he stated privately to them that Gary Caradore had been assassinated. So it's really difficult to know where Colby was at with it. He was willing to state that Gary Caradore had been murdered privately, but he wasn't willing to state it publicly. But William Colby also died a very mysterious death in the wake of all this. And I get into his death, his very mysterious death, in the book, too.
So did you total up how many mysterious deaths there seem to be that you uncovered?
There were a lot of mysterious deaths affiliated with Franklin. Unfortunately, I just went for the mysterious deaths and suicides that I could prove of people that were affiliated with Franklin. And I think there's approximately 10.
10?
Yes.
And have you received any kind of threats or that concerned you?
I had one death threat early on, and that was it.
Okay.
But I've experienced considerable harassment too. So other than the death threat, there has been a tremendous amount of harassment.
So is there anything that you feel that viewing the climate that's taken place with the Vatican right now and some of the controversy around the priests and some of these schools that may not have been necessarily all Catholic, because it seemed to be some Canadian schooling where a lot of Native Americans went through some horrific things that they experienced, and yet they're confronting the Vatican on their blaming them in certain arenas. Have you connected with any of these other groups, or do you pretty much just look at this one arena and see it as disjointed and not tied in at all?
Well, since I've been investigating Franklin, power broker pedophile networks have been uncovered in Mexico, Venezuela, Belgium, and also Portugal. And I think that there was one that was nearly uncovered in Great Britain that went up to Blair's cabinet, at least according to Counterpunch magazine. So there is, I have gotten wind of a number of power broker pedophile networks that have been covered up. The one in Belgium is very similar to Frank. But what's interesting about the one in Belgium, there was blackmail and also the occult involved in that. There were actually law enforcement that came out and said that there was a cover-up. Excuse me. And in the United States, there was no law enforcement that came out and said that there was a pedophile network being covered up. And another strange thing is that there were over 100,000 Belgians that took to the street in protest of this pedophile network being covered up. And in Nebraska, there were like 50 people that took to the streets. So that's not a very good commentary on the United States of America pertaining to its protection of children that are being molested.
Did you find any tie-in with it to social services in various states?
Well, I believe the first kid that came forward, and you've got to read my book if you really want to understand this, but the first kid that came forward was out of a foster care home. And that foster care home had approximately 8 children living there. And these kids were, some of them were molested. They were all beat. They were all starved. They were treated basically like animals. And no one ever got indicted for that. There was no crimes, even though I've got all the social service or a lot of the social service documentation on this foster care home. And all the sexual abuse that went on there, the physical abuse, the foster parents starving the kids. I mean, it's just unbelievable what these foster parents got away with. And now there was a social worker that was responsible for putting kids into that house, and I eventually found that social worker, and she was living in California, but she would not return my calls. So I do think that there was some collusion, although social services personnel were the first people to trumpet this. But I think that there was some lower-level collusion with social services. Or there certainly may have been some lower-level collusion with social services personnel concerning this network and getting kids for the network.
Did you find a common denominator when you were looking at these various countries that had these networks showed up in?
They were all covered up.
So you really didn't have...
I mean, there were a couple of people indicted, but there were much more powerful people that weren't indicted. And in the Portugal network, they were getting kids out of Portugal's equivalent to Boys Town.
So I know that you pretty much stick with the facts and whatever, but don't you, whether you have to name it or not, but didn't you kind of come up with some kind of... idea as to what led to all this and why is it condoned and nothing is done about it? I mean, is it because of it?
Well, it's definitely not condoned. I mean, it's not condoned by the American people. I mean, if the American people knew about this, it would not have been condoned. I mean, it was covered up, but it wasn't condoned. I mean, if the people would have known about it, there would have been a tremendous amount of outrage. People wouldn't have condoned it. Unfortunately, it was covered up, so the people had no idea, or most of the people had no idea what was actually going down.
Yeah, but the people that were involved in on the cover up had to be condoning it just by the fact that they were covering it up.
Well, I mean, they were condoning it, or they were covering it up because either they were compromised or they wanted to get bumped up the judicial totem pole. If you read my book, you'll see that various officers that helped prosecute the girl that wouldn't recant or helped steer Larry King away from subpoenas and indictments experienced tremendous upward mobility in the federal and state judiciary.
And that's not unlike what's going on out there in our world right now. And this is why, I mean, this is one of the most horrific examples, and I'm sure there's probably things that would probably even put it to shame if we knew about it. But when we start...
Well, this is pretty ugly if you look at it in totality. I mean, it's pretty ugly.
Well, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that we don't know all of what's going on because we see that so much is covered up in so many different events. And so what do you hope to accomplish by all this?
Well, according to who's doing the estimates, there's 1 to 300,000 American children that are trafficked domestically every year. 1 to 300,000. That's a lot of children that are being trafficked, American children that are being trafficked domestically. And nobody ever gets busted for it. It's always some guy that lives in a trailer park that's smoking crack with a 14-year-old that gets busted. I mean, very seldom do prominent people get busted soliciting the services of underage prostitutes. I mean, it's very, 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 very rare. And so basically, you've got this huge number of children that are being trafficked right now, American children. And nobody is ever, there's no large networks that are getting busted for it. There's one or two people that are responsible or that are pandering one or two or three kids. But if you look at the numbers, 100 to 300,000, obviously these large networks are in existence. Right now, as we speak, kids are being trafficked in very well-organized, refined networks that are protected. I believe that. It has to be if you look at the copious number of children that are being trafficked, and nobody's getting busted for trafficking those children. I mean, there has to be large networks that are being covered up. So that's a disease in our society. That is a disease. When you've got children being trafficked and the traffickers being protected by law enforcement, that's a disease. And what my book does is it diagnoses a disease. And it shows that these large networks exist and how they're covered up. So if your listeners read my book, they'll see that I've diagnosed a disease. And the only way that you can get rid of a disease is by first diagnosing it. You cannot, if you've got cancer and you're not diagnosed with cancer, you're going to die of cancer. I mean, it's going to kill you. But if you know that you have cancer, then you can get chemotherapy. So what my book is a diagnosis of a disease. And I just need as many people as possible to read it to understand that this disease is alive and well and flourishing in America. And then at that point, we can take corrective measures to cut out this tumor that's within the American society.
Even though it's a disease, it's really systemic of other things, and that's what I see going on here. How many of these kids did you run into that became a part of the trafficking themselves and started recruiting kids of their own?
Not too many. There was really one or two. Most of the kids that I talked to were pretty fried by the time that these guys were done with them. And they'd become drug addicts and pretty much useless to the network.
Uh-huh.
So they were basically expunged, and they would eventually be arrested for various offenses, ranging from drug addiction or drug possession to possession of child pornography. Some of these kids or victims are very, very damaged.
Did you run into anybody and when you're in your research, some of the other investigators and journalists, maybe something where along with Ted Gunderson or Jim Rothstein or some of the perpetrators like Michael Aquino or the McMartin case, did you run into these other tie-ins with these people or events?
Throughout the course of my investigation, I talked to a lot of different people and got a lot of different perspectives. But as I said earlier, the only thing I put in my book is stuff that I could prove. And that's primarily what I'm actually willing to talk about is stuff that's in my book that I can prove. I don't want to go off onto some tangent of conjecture and surmise, because then I'll be labeled a conspiracy theorist when I'm not. I mean, my book is about a conspiracy reality. So I choose to exclusively stick to subject matter that's in my book. I don't like to surmise about other investigators or what I think about them. Or
you didn't really want to corroborate with any of their work there? Did you found anything that tied in with yours that helped build your case?
I mean, throughout the course of my 7-year investigation, I heard of other networks. But to prove the network that I proved, and I had like a grand jury's worth of sealed documentation to prove it, and most investigators aren't that lucky. But I heard of a number of other networks that have been in existence or possibly are still in existence. But it took me 7 years, and I traveled 40,000 miles to prove what's in my book. So to prove one of these networks exist, to prove the conspiracy, takes a tremendous amount of work. And there have been other networks that have come up, but they just weren't proven to the extent that I felt like I proved the Franklin network.
Okay, and so it didn't cross over. Did the Franklin at all cross over into the Bohemian Grove?
Not really, no.
Okay. And is there anybody that we've managed to leave out in this discussion is that you felt was significant in your book that people should be aware of? I know that DynCorp got popped for trafficking. Would that have had a tie-in at all either?
Well, that was in Eastern Europe.
Okay.
And that really... there was some Blackwater activity with trafficking in Iraq too. But no, I did not find a tie into that. I basically just stuck with the facts that I could prove, and I did not find a tie in with DynCorp.
Okay, and as far as with these grand juries go, when you were able to find some of this information that tied in with these guys, and yet they came up with a verdict or whatever you want to call what they come up with that totally flies in the face of the reality of it. What do you think about these grand juries, and is this something that we should even...
Well, there again, I mean, if you want to see, I mean, it's against the law for me. I published grand jury excerpts, people talking at the grand jury. That's against the law for me. I mean, that's against the law. That was sealed grand jury documentation. That was against the law for me to do that. But if someone really wants to understand how a grand jury is hijacked or co-opted, they can read my book, because I show exactly how this grand jury was hijacked. But again, you have to read my book, because I can say that a grand jury was co-opted. I can say that kids were flown around the country. I can say that there was a house in Washington, D.C. that was owned by a CIA asset that was bugged for audio and visual blackmail. I mean, I can say all these things, but they're kind of meaningless unless you read my book, because my book proves it. And until you read my book, I mean, everything that I say, I mean, could be construed as somebody who is lost his mind, and I would fully understand that. But if you read my book, you'll see that I actually prove everything.
Okay. In other words, you've got the documentation and everything that backs up what you're trying to.
I mean, I've got excerpts from the grand jury of people talking and telling lies. And I show how that they were prompted to tell lies. I mean, I show it in my book. I've got excerpts from grand jury testimony. So, yes, in the book I show exactly how to co-opt a grand jury. And I think very few books, I'm the only book that I know of that has actually brought a reader into an actual grand jury, because it's illegal. But I felt like this grand jury was just so rotten and corrupt that I had every right to publish the testimony, because it was just so corrupt. I mean, I felt like it was within my right to do that.
And so nobody's able to approach any of these grand jurors after the fact? I mean, because I saw, like, Hoppe Heidelberg in the Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, he definitely came out and spoke about some of the things that he endured during his proceedings that he had to deal with on one of these juries.
No, none of these grand jurors came out, but, I mean, I had the grand jury testimony, so I really didn't need to, I had the test. I showed exactly how the grand jury was co-opted, so I really didn't need to get any of the grand jurors to talk. I mean, that grand jury lasted 4 months, and these grand jurors were inundated with truths and lies, and actually the special prosecutor even called someone who was clearly unhinged to the stand, who said that the FDA was infiltrated by KGB agents. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that is. So after 4 months of truth and lies and innuendo and schizophrenics and just everything that could be thrown at grand jurors, after 4 months of this, they're completely run down. And then I believe at that point, the grand jury report was written without much input from the grand jurors. I mean, they were just exhausted. They had heard and listened to everything, and they didn't know which end was up by the end of this grand jury. They were just, everything was thrown at them. There was a lot of truth thrown at them, but there was a lot of lies thrown at them, and then And then there was just sheer, like I said, in my book, I excerpt the testimony of someone who's clearly unhinged, who's saying that the FBI or the FDA has been infiltrated by KGB agents. Now, why would a special prosecutor who's investigating child abuse, why would he call someone like that, who's clearly unhinged, who knows nothing about child abuse, who knows nothing about the case, but he believes that the FDA has been infiltrated by KGB agents? I mean, that's just one example of how absurd the grand jury was that I basically show was co-opted in the book.
So ultimately, you're bringing out the fact that they're manipulated, and that a lot of, but at the same time, it appears as though they were also corrupt in their own right, and they're coming to their decision. Or do you feel that it was outside the?
As I said earlier, I believe that those grand jurors were just ordinary citizens who were called to jury duty, and then they got stuck on this grand jury, and they were there for 4 months from 9 to 5, being inundated with gushing lies, with gushing truth, with schizophrenics, with all kinds of stuff that had nothing to do with child abuse.
Jeez.
And by the end of the 4 months, 9 to 5, 5 days a week, by the end of the 4 months, they didn't know which end was up. And I think at that point, the grand jury report was then written. I really shed a lot of insight into that grand jury in the book, and it's important to read the book.
Right, and it is important, and from numerous aspects, because I've seen in the research that I do in other unrelated arenas, I'm finding these grand juries to be problematic, and yet I'm hearing from other people thinking that they may be the savior, but I don't know how.
Depends upon the special prosecutor. If the special prosecutor is a righteous guy that's out for justice, you'll get righteous indictments from a grand jury. If a special prosecutor is tainted and wants to cover up something, then you'll get false indictments or no indictments from a grand jury. It's really dependent upon how corrupt or uncorrupt the special prosecutor or the grand jury is. That's basically it.
Would you do this again, or with a different subject, or further this subject on?
Well, right now I'm in the midst of working on a documentary on this, on the Franklin scandal, and that's kind of my next stop as far as projects with this. But I really want to break this into the American consciousness. As I said, my book diagnoses a disease, and I really want my fellow Americans to understand this disease so something can be done about it, so we can band together and do something about the disease. And then also the blackmailing of politicians. When I was writing this book, the congressional approval rating was 12%. So that means that 88% of Americans feel that, when I was writing this book, feel that the Congress was not acting within their will. 88% of Americans. Now, the pundits would say that it's special interest money. But I think that the Franklin scandal exposes another mechanism, blackmail. And the pundits never bring up blackmail. I mean, it's never talked about on Meet the Press or any of these other shows. People have no idea that there's this huge checks and balance system within their political structure that has nothing to do with we the people. It's we the blackmailers and we the blackmailed.
And
it
almost appears that some of these congressmen, too, can become victims of these events.
Well, I believe that a number of congressmen were blackmailed. And are being blackmailed.
And then those that survived it, this is so endemic in so many areas of our life, and to have to, it's really sad to see that you know, we have this sort of thing going on, but we can't even, you know, bring perpetrators of events that show, you know, the corruption and the things that should be, people should be held accountable, like, you know, bankers that you know, take off with money and can come and tell the, you know, the people that, you know, they don't have to tell them where it went.
Well, I think Americans are kind of used to financial malfeasance. We've, the bankers have been guilty of financial malfeasance. I mean, you had the 80s and then you have the 90s. And I think that child abuse is something that, especially interstate pedophile networks, I think that that's something that can wake up Americans. Because Americans, I think Americans will put their foot down with child abuse. I think that everybody has children, or they have nephews, or they have nieces. So I think child abuse is a, and the Franklin scandal is a story that can wake up America to show just how corrupt and perfidious the government can be, or certainly a corrupt subgenus within the government.
Well, I sure hope so, but it also shows that, you know, the bankers aren't so far from it. So, I mean,
well,
even though in this case it was one person, but, you know, it once they start crossing over that line, it doesn't seem like they, you know, it's far to...
Well, one of the congressmen that has come up in my investigation as a pedophile was one of the main cheerleaders for the bailout. So there you've got a crossover right there.
Right, right. So, you know, Nick, I really appreciate you expounding on your important work with this Franklin scandal, and I'm sure that many people would glean a lot from reading your book. And your website, again, is thefranklinscandal.com, is that right?
Yes, franklinscandal.com.
And again, I want to thank you, and I hope that people read your book. And is there any closing thoughts?
It's just, it's, as I said earlier, I kind of want to hammer this point home, is that we have a disease in our society, and it's the use and abuse of children, the organized use and abuse of children. And, it's a disease that has gone undiagnosed. And, my book provides a definitive diagnosis. And the more Americans that read my book, the more they will be edified. And at that point, when we get sufficient enough numbers, then we can do something about this disease.
And I certainly hope so. So, again, I want to say good night.
Thank you, Melody. Have yourself a great night.